This is TLV1.
The Tel Aviv Review with Gilad Halpern.
Hello and welcome to the Tel Aviv Review, a program dedicated to the word, to the thought and to debate. I'm your host, Gilad Halpern, and every week I'll be engaging in close encounters of the intellectual kind with writers and scholars, or simply people of ideas of all types and vocations who have done something to make our lives a tad more interesting. My guest today is a historian, a fellow at the Middle East Forum, and co-author of the new book, Religion, Politics, and the Origins of Palestine Refugee Relief, that has recently been published in English by Palgrave Macmillan. It recounts the involvement of American religious groups in diplomacy and refugee relief during Israel's War of Independence and in its immediate aftermath. Dr. Asaf Romirowski, welcome to the Tel Aviv Review. You're joining us on the line from Philadelphia.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So when it comes to the Palestinian refugee question, the first organization that comes to mind is, of course, UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. But it was set up only in mid-1950, 2 years, if not more, after the Palestinian refugees became a diplomatic question to be reckoned with. What was the situation of international relief before that?
Well, before that, there was a small operation that was called the United Nations Relief for Palestine Refugees, otherwise known as UNRPR. And in between 1948 and 1949, there was a group of administrators that were UN related, as well as other kind of groups. And one of those groups was the American Friends Service Committee, the AFSC. There was another one called the International Committee of the Red Cross. Then there was a League of Red Cross Societies, groups that were involved in administering relief, especially at the beginning of World War One, World War Two, that continued onward, that were still involved in hotspot zones that required humanitarian aid and relief.
So not just in Palestine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what role did American religious groups play in this scheme of affairs? I mean, I wouldn't think that they would be considered as the usual suspects, would they?
No, they wouldn't. I mean, what was interesting about the focus of the book and the focus of the research that I've done has been focused on the American Friends Service Committee, the AFSC, which are really the Quakers. The Quakers historically got involved in the aftermath of World War One to try to help with human suffering around the world, and they've been involved in such kind of activities. What was interesting about the story of the AFSC is that the Quakers were actually involved in the DP camps. They were involved in the kinder transports. They had some experience in dealing with European Jewry. And what happened before they got to Gaza and to the region itself was that as a result of their success that led to actually a Nobel Peace Prize, Eleanor Roosevelt offered them the mandate of dealing with the Middle East. And of course, obviously, even back then, the attractiveness to actually solve conflict between Arabs and Jews was something they could not turn down. And so the Quakers took on this program. And historically speaking, it is probably the largest relief refugee program they've ever undertaken, and was the last one. And you know, I'm happy to that's part of the story of how they got involved in the Middle East and what they learned there a result of the.
We're going to get to that in a minute, to the short-lived experience and why that happened. But I'm going to ask you about the interest in Israeli-Arab conflict in the first place. Did it have any religious elements to it? After all, it was the Holy Land.
Sure. I mean, the Quakers were pacifists by nature. However, they believed in religious diplomacy, and they had many of the phraseology that was used in the Quaker documents was truce of God type documents, and the idea that there was a belief that as pacifists, they could be seen as neutral, to a point even that one of the main leaders, there was a proposal on the table that of all people who should be the mayor of Jerusalem, of course that it should be the Quakers, because they'd be the only individuals who would know how to deal with three monotheistic religions. Mm-hmm. So they came at it with this perspective, with the hope that it would give them leverage and neutrality, and allow them to get to an interesting kind of individuals. Namely, even during Nazi Germany, they went and they go on to meet with Heydrich and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. They meet with different individuals that had enough power that they could sway as a result of their neutrality, but with the idea that they have no political angle here, but they have only the interest of solving human suffering.
Mm-hmm. And how was this received by the Zionist leadership here in Israel, Palestine, and the Palestinian Arab leadership?
Well, it's there are two angles to look at here. I mean, I think that there were definitely meetings with the chief rabbis in Israel at the time, Herzog, namely. They had many meetings with Ben Gurion, but more meetings with Charette at the time, and Charette was assigned to deal with the Quakers. I think that the Quakers, Charette was open to explaining to them what the needs are. I mean, they came with a very neutral mentality, and they also had, I would say, religious naivete, for lack of a better term, that really religious individuals would respond to their pleas. But when they met, for example, with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, they left there totally disillusioned by the fact that he's really not a religious figure, but a ideologue. And so this was a difficult learning process that they learned. But the Zionists were open to any kind of help at the time. And of course, the Quakers, because of their success and their standing in world affairs, they were not only American Quakers, but also British Quakers, they were open to having these conversations and seeing such proposals play out. Even before this project comes about in Gaza, I mean, there has been obviously Quaker involvement in the Middle East. One of the oldest orphanages in the area is still located in Ramallah. I mean, so they've been involved in smaller end-type projects, and so they felt that this kind of success story would allow them to get to these kind of individuals. With the Egyptians, and of course, much of the base of operations was not only Egypt, but was also based out of Beirut, and they also had some dealings with the Iraqis. Again, it started to become a rude awakening, for lack of a better term, to try to understand Arab politics and dealing with, specifically the Egyptians and how they saw the situation, how the Egyptians saw the Palestinian Arabs, and that became they started to have a real working relationship with them, though they also came across many of the cleavages that we talk about regarding, fast forward to UNRWA today, as far as the duality, the identity issues, the problematic issues that are still infested the whole mentality of dealing with the Arab world, specifically when it comes to Palestine. Mm. And so those were things that they came across. And to a point, even when from the Arab-Palestinian local proletariat, basically, they still believed and they saw the Quakers as another vehicle to get them back what was perceived as their own. So again, the Nakba mentality that is still is part of the fabric of Palestinian identity did come into play when the Quakers dealt with the Palestinian Arabs. However, they did understand that they were there to administer relief, and for that, they were willing to, they needed them, even for the basic needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there are really two separate questions here. Relief or charity on the one hand and diplomacy on the other, that are really two extremely separate questions. And I want to focus on the latter, on the diplomatic efforts. Did the Quakers, you said that they were a force to be reckoned with internationally, but did they really have any political leverage or any political savvy, or were their diplomatic efforts really set up to fail?
Well, you know, again, that's a two-pronged question, but I think it's an interesting way to look at it. Quakerism at large is about doing. They're less organized, religiously speaking, about actually going to any kind of house of worship. So the idea that you're going to do something and help was part of how they motivated and got people to volunteer. And so many of the individuals who came to Gaza and even were involved prior to that in the Middle East and even World War One and whatnot were involved because of the idea of trying to help get involved in areas of conflict as a result of the pacifistic look. They were involved. I mean, you know, in many of the meetings, they were invited. The Secretary General of the AFSC, Clarence Pickett, and others were involved in the meeting with high-end individuals at the State Department. They were involved in the meetings on Lake Success. They were involved in many of these religious efforts and relief efforts, and they were around the table as a result of having the field work experience. Clarence Pickett, you know, reached a certain amount of cachet even later on in the 60s, where, you know, there would be, you know, if you look at the documents, if you look at the Quaker story, where they would be protesting, for example, the Vietnam War, but on the next, but on the same night while he's protesting the White House, he'd be invited to the White House ball and met with JFK and others. So they had a certain amount of cachet within American society. You know, as a sidebar, now there were two well-known, obviously, you know, Quaker presidents, namely Hoover and Nixon. But that didn't really, you know, translate into you know, larger political cachet. A lot of what they produced was many academics who got involved in international affairs as a result of the kind of worldwide experience that they had. But those meetings allowed them to raise the bar as far as the need for the kind of expertise they had.
I'm asking yourself because I'd like to know, in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, to what extent did they assist or interfere in the realignment of American interests in the Middle East? And I'm talking namely about the first chapters of the Cold War.
Well, their involvement post-World War II and even during World War II was based on saving lives. I mean, you know, when they talk about their knowledge of the of knowing Jews, they will point to the Kinder transports. They will point to the ability to save Jews, help with DP camps. They will report about the fact that they've met with Heydrich in order to save Jews and get them out of, or try to attempt to help as a result of what was happening. And so from that stance, that's where they came out of it. I mean, the story itself speaks volumes. Of a larger issue regarding American Protestant relief, and you know how Americans, you know, Protestants got involved in different areas of conflict, but namely the Middle East. When you talk about individuals who are all going to the region, specifically the Middle East, to try to resolve areas of conflict and to try to help, you know, as well as to try to bring about other kinds of religiosity and the perspective of converts, and as well as getting involved in the Middle East, you know, groups that were involved in as far as creating American University of Cairo and American University of Beirut. I mean, those were all larger Protestant relief operations that relied on kind of bringing a different westernized Protestant view to
the region. None of this clashed with the new realpolitik of the Cold War?
It started to. I mean, the Quakers themselves, you know, as far as, you know, their involvement, you know, with the British Quakers as well as the American Quakers, they saw larger threats. I mean, their pacifism is what led them to, what drove them to get involved. Where they saw a bigger threat than all of this, and which is, you know, part of the Quaker story, was the threat of nuclear armament. I mean, so that was where they drew the line as far as getting involved with protesting, trying to deal with the Republic of China and the Soviets and whatnot. Those became bigger issues for them as far as the realignment. This was seen even in diplomatic circles and even within UN circles as religious diplomacy that would help people in need as a result of the larger realpolitik arena that was created. And this was a way to kind of deal with that as far as leveraging that kind of diplomatic stance, B, their role with Dean Acheson and other kind of State Department high-end individuals, their connection, of course, to Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, those are the kind of things they brought to the table. And, of course, the ability to provide real skill set and real relief operations. I mean, that was, you know, your first question about the end goal of these kind of projects. The Quakers were extremely critical, to their credit, and extremely convinced that the only solution to the Arab-Palestinian situation has to have an end game. So repatriation, reintegration, and resettlement was key. And those three R's were actually the backbone of American foreign policy diplomacy at the time. Any area that American foreign policy got involved in was part of repatriation, resettlement, and reintegration. One of the few cases where we went against them, I mean, as far as American foreign policy, against their own foreign policy, was the Palestine case study, where we have given up on the idea of repatriation, resettlement, and reintegration in exchange for allowing for what has now become UNRWA's main vehicle, education, or so they claim. And so that's also part of the story.
And is the fact that these three R's were going nowhere, was this the reason for the end of their relief efforts in Palestine?
In fact, it was. I mean, as I said early on, I mean, this was the largest operation the Quakers ever took on, and to their credit, they did run a tight ship. I mean, they were able to create an administer relief in a very positive way. I mean, this is part of where, you know, in the book we talk about the fact that lessons learned that were not learned in the transition to UNRWA. I mean, all the questions that we talk about regarding UNRWA, the question of who is a refugee and a true census of how many Palestinian refugees there actually are. Where do they come from? Who deserves the kind of aid, the skill set? This was all part of what the Quakers were trying to do, and they came across these questions just the fact of being on the ground and trying to set up a shop to know the population. But their end game was that there has to be an end game. There has to be either a integration, or there has to be repatriation or resettlement, and the problem has to go away. One of the reasons, and this is, you know, an interesting part of the conversation, when the United Nations, you know, and UNRWA comes about, they actually turn to the Quakers because they had the live experience, they had the skill set, they've been in the region, they were the subject matter experts, for lack of a better term, to stay on and to help with the transition. And part of the refusal was that they saw UNRWA and the large United Nations at large as a larger bureaucracy of red tape that was not going to bring about reintegration, resettlement, or repatriation. And so that's why after the 18-month project basically ended and the money kind of dried up and there was this transition into UNRWA, they decided not to continue on with this kind of large-scale operation.
And 65 years on, it seems that they were right. Dr. Asaf Romirowski, a fellow at the Middle East Forum and co-author of the new book, Religion, Politics, and the Origins of Palestine Refugee Relief. Thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our show today. Thank you very much for listening. Also, big thanks to Alex Benish, the technical producer of this show. I am Gilad Halpern, signing off here in Tel Aviv. Do join us again next week for another edition of the Tel Aviv Review. And until then, goodbye.
והיא לבד מול הטלוויזיה. בבית הכנסת הסמוך מתפללים ערבית, מעבירה לה את הזמן ואת הכאב בעזרת קוסנס קפה.